And welcome, dear listeners, to Season 6 of Food Conversations. Of course, first, we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Shkremik people. And I believe that doing what we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Well, we're going to start this season off with a bang, exploring one of the most visible and inspiring features in the food landscape in the Shuswap, and that is the downtown Salmon Arm Farmers Market. And there are no better people to help us understand what the market is all about than our two guests today. They are Howie McMillan and Jennifer Chenecki, respectively coordinator and manager of this highly successful service to the community. Now, I'm calling it a service, not an institution, because it's a very vibrant, living entity that is it is our farmers market. So welcome, Howie and Jennifer, to Food Conversations.
Thanks, Warren.
Great to have you here. And this is a topic that we really probably should have addressed about 2 years ago, because it's such a feature of what we do in Salmon Arm. Now, we're going to talk a little bit later about how Howie, investment portfolio manager, and Jennifer, an artist come museum and gallery curator, arrived in the world of farmers markets. But first, let's plunge into a recent survey that has put the important and valuable role of the farmers market into focus. So, Howie, let's start with you. How did this survey come about? This was not just us.
No, it was organized by the BC Association of Farmers Markets and commissioned through University of Northern BC, who designed the survey. And their goal was to survey 70 farmers markets throughout the province. Last I heard, they've done 45 or 50 of them.
So it's an ongoing project.
Yeah. They did another one in 2012, and now they want to update that and see what's changed and that type of thing. So ours was conducted in mid-June of this year, and a crew from the BC Farmers Market Association came and conducted the survey, and we rallied a group of volunteers, and Jennifer and I helped with that process. The survey was about 3 hours in duration, and did a fairly thorough job of looking at our farmers market and how it relates to the rest of the farmers market community in the province.
Jennifer, what was the methodology? How did they do it on the ground?
Well, they were doing it in two ways. So we had some lovely people come out from the BC Association of Farmers Market, and they set up a couple of flip charts and gave passerbyers stickers, and people were weighing in on a few questions: how much they usually spend, how often they come down, and then how often or what they'll spend additional money on in the community if they're just coming down for the farmers market or if they go and do another shop here or there in the community. So that was sort of the factual information gathering methodology that they used.
A sticker method.
Always, yeah, and it was very beautiful and visual, and they also engaged a lot with people on the way as well and took notes, so that was quite interesting.
And so they would walk around in the market and buttonhole people and say...
They were set up, but they would bring people over to them, so yeah. And then we also had a group of volunteers and myself, and we kind of personed the main entrance points into the market.
Well done. Went from man to person.
Yeah. And so what we did was we spent 10 minutes collecting information on who was coming in. And it was quite, I thought it was quite thorough because I was one of the counters. So I could see if somebody was coming in and going back out, or it was easy enough. So we were just collecting 10-minute data chunks once an hour. And then they would, times them by six and take an average.
What kind of questions? Do you remember any of the questions and what they were sort of focused on when they were talking to people? They must have had a bit of a structured interview approach.
Yeah, I think it was mostly to do with the flip charts, but they were also asking people what kind of stuff they were spending their money on, whether it was produce or bread or eggs or gifts or flowers, stuff like that. Yeah.
So you got results from this. Did they come in right away, or how did they take a while to get in?
We got a preliminary report so far, and we're to get a thorough final report sometime this fall.
Oh, that late?
But yeah. We have some interesting data points at this point, but we won't see the full comprehensive study. They did two basic surveys, a short form, which was just a series of five questions, I believe, and then they got a number of people to do a long form survey as well, and I think that's what takes them time to process, so we won't see those results until later.
So what do we know at this point, Jennifer? What do we know about what they found out that I think listeners would probably like to hear? What the heck is going on at that farmer's market?
Well, some of the things that I was really interested to hear was the amount of money people spend there. You know, people were spending an average of $40 to $60, which is a great amount to come to spend. And a lot of people were coming weekly, which was great to see, or at least a couple times a month. So, and then there was, of course, a large economic impact on the greater community, which is so important.
Can you give a rough figure for that, either of you? Do you have the number?
Yeah. Again, their methodology is an attempt to kind of approximate over the course of the year. So they attended one market close to our peak season for attendance. And at that point, that particular day, they guesstimated the attendance to be somewhere in the 2,800 to 2,900 people through the course of the four-hour market.
That's a heck of a lot of people.
Yeah.
In a town of 17,000.
It is. And again, their estimates on spending, as Jennifer mentioned, they did a survey of, you know, different models and that type of thing. And they guesstimate from that, both that day, what people responded they would spend, and the average, as Jennifer said, was in that $35 or $40 per patron at the market. And then essentially, because our market runs year-round, and last year our winter market was only bi-weekly, they sort of prorate that, and they got us to give them some estimates of, compared to today, how was the attendance. And it kind of peaks in August, and then by February, you know, it's one-fifth of the number of
people.
So they
kind of extrapolated and modified.
So they use a formula to kind of there. So they were able to ascertain that basically the attendance and the spending at the market over the course of the year, which in the bi-weekly thing in the winter, that we have, I think, would have been 36 or 37 markets. They estimated then that the total spending for the year would have been somewhere in the $1.6 million based on that criteria. And then they did a formula for what they call added value to that, because every one of our vendors, of course, has to spend that money that they take in at the market on inputs, their seeds, their fertilizer, their fuel, all of these types of things.
Sure.
Plus they shop in the community as well. They all live here in Salmon Arm, the Sherwood. So they used a multiplier to estimate that total economic activity value would have then come in at somewhere around $2.4 million. Which, when you're at the market each day, you got to think, well, we're doing a multi-million dollar revenue stream to the economy. It's kind of encouraging. And as Jennifer mentioned, they also ask people what they did once they were downtown. Did they shop elsewhere? How much would they spend? And these people, 233 people responded to the survey, indicated that they, on average, would spend somewhere around $40 or $45 elsewhere at merchants in the downtown once they're there. So they added all that and crunched it through their formula and suggested that the economic benefit there would be in the millions of dollars as well. So it is a one-day, four-hour event, but it is an actual major contributor to the local economy. We're talking about millions of dollars.
Jennifer, when you've been working with the market for, this is your first year, mm-hmm. did you sense that you were engaging in an operation that was a multi-million dollar economic boost to the community?
Yeah, I don't know if I thought it was that big, but I certainly saw it as a thriving, bustling hub of the downtown. So I could see that there was a lot of value, however you sort of look at it.
Well, now we've got the farmers market situated in three-dimensional space. Maybe it's time to talk a little bit about how each of you got into this exciting and very vibrant kind of activity. So Howie, homesteader parents in the Caribou. I remember reading a book, it was once something beyond the mountains, and it was about a family that had homesteaded. I don't think it was your family, but it was the sort of thing that you got started. That was your start.
Yeah, both my parents were actual homesteaders, mm-hmm. In that they came to the South Cariboo region, which at that time in my mom's family's case was 1913, I believe, and she was born in 1934. And my dad's family came to the area in 1925, and he was born in 1928. There wasn't much there, so if you didn't grow it or harvest it...
Food was critical.
Essentially, my dad told the stories when he was a youngster of twice-a-year wagon trips to Ashcroft, which at that time was the head of the railroad, to buy 50 pounds of coffee and 50 pounds of sugar and that sort of thing.
By the time you got down to the last pound, it was a little stale.
Could be.
But and you needed it.
Again, that was the only coffee there was in the South Cariboo in the 1910, 1920, 1930 period of time. So they were avid homesteaders in the sense that they were gardeners, they were farmers, they were hunters, they were trappers.
Whatever you had to do.
Because that's the only source of feeding yourself.
And just to air a different note on this subject, of course, this was an era when the indigenous people of the area progressively, and it happened around here in Salmon Arm, progressively woke up one morning to see a fence across where they had gone to gather some wild crop.
Yeah.
Did you guys interact with the indigenous community at the time? And a lot of people didn't. They were sort of separate worlds.
Actually, that's a good question in that my great-grandfather, Ed Higgins, when he came, he was first from Central Oregon in the Eugene area, and he came to the Cariboo on hunting and fishing expeditions in the 1910-1920 area, and he moved his entire family there in 1913, and the only people who knew anything about where things were and where you could get this and all that were the indigenous people. And he had a real good rapport with them. He was a road builder and a bridge constructor, and he conversed with them and determined, you know, how they got to Kenem Lake or how they got into the town and that type of thing. So, yeah, it was a good rapport simply because they were the knowledgeable people.
Of course they were. Of course they were. Now, your father and his brother went into the sawmill business, and it was so successful that they retired when your father was 50. As you pointed out earlier when we were talking, that's an unusual thing for a farmer to be retiring at age 50. Usually somebody like an investment portfolio manager gets to do that. Now, Jennifer, you came from another part of this country, born in Vigreville. Why don't you explain to listeners where Vigreville is located and what kind of a community is?
It's just about an hour east of Edmonton, and it's a Ukrainian settlement community. It's still widely Ukrainian to this day, I think about 80 to 90%.
Ukrainian culture.
Yeah.
How did that shape your world?
Well, I had a lot of egg decorating and sewing and traditional wheat craft in my upbringing, and I think it was a lot about food, truly.
Yes, you, and that brings me to the grandmother story.
Yeah.
You had two grandmothers who played a really important role in your life.
Yeah, they did. I actually have a similar story to Howie, and that's that my grandparents were also homesteaders and cattle ranchers on one side. So I grew up in my early years a lot with my grandmothers who were babysitting us all, and I spent a lot of time in the garden over the first 10 or 15 years of my life.
As with Howie, gardens were a genuine source of food to eat, not just a hobby.
My grandmother had a basement full of canned goods, the whole thing. We used to raid the peaches sometimes and then get in trouble.
Invisible peach disappearance story. But also you learned about, they were skillful women. Mm-hmm. They were women who knew a lot. They knew how to do things.
Yeah, I learned a lot of skills from those years and things like sewing and just basic skills that maybe kids nowadays don't quite get full on. Or sometimes they do, but I think...
And you were certainly encouraged to do what you felt you wanted to do.
I would say so. Alberta was a really free time in my life. I would kind of get sent over there for summer vacation once we moved to here. So I had, you know, my parents weren't always there, and it was just a really enjoyable, lovely time.
So you could really, as you did, head off into a different kind of life focus without anybody getting concerned about it.
Yeah.
And Howie, that was the same for you, too. Your family sort of said to you, do what you think is the thing you want to do.
Yeah. One of the few advantages, I guess, of being old now is when I was a boy...
Howie, you're not old.
The freedom to roam around and do whatever. My only expectation as a youngster in home was when supper bell rang, you came for supper, and if you were late, there were repercussions.
And work for Pavlov, it'll work for your family.
And again, be home when it got dark type of thing. But from there, we roamed and did whatever we could and had a great deal of freedom as a child. But when I look at my grandkids now, it would be you couldn't allow them the freedoms that we enjoyed when we were kids.
Now, Jennifer, you went off into a world, the world of fine arts.
I did, yeah.
What led you to head off in that direction?
You know, I was in physics 12 and I just wasn't liking it. So I transferred over into art 12, and I'd been studying art for a lot of my life, but that was a major turning point in my life when I switched over and kind of changed my career path and decided to go to Emily Carr.
Emily Carr University, mm-hmm. as it is now called.
It was an institute when I went, and I quite loved that, actually. It was very unique.
It was. I was actually looking up a little of the history of Emily Carr mm-hmm. because it really is quite well known. It's the only arts school that is from Canada that's in the top 25 mm-hmm. art schools around the world. And
apparently it was hard to get into.
Yes, it was. I know family members who tried to get in and didn't always succeed.
Right.
Howie, you went off into the world of business, which obviously is not quite the same as being a homesteader, although you made it clear that you were always kind of a foodie. How did that path open up for you?
Again, I grew up in a very free environment and was encouraged to pursue whatever I was interested in. And I had an uncle, my mom's sister's husband, who was a stockbroker. And I was always kind of fascinated with that. So that's what got me into the financial side of things. And from there, I evolved into a portfolio management role and a more of an investment analyst type of role. It was just a natural sort of progression because I admired the man. And then when he would talk about what he was doing and that type of thing. And of course, my parents were business people. They owned and operated a sawmill and a logging operation. So I had that kind of
business
flavor type to my upbringing. So it was a natural progression to get into that. But I would add that although I'd spent 20 years in that field, it was one of a number of things that...
You preempted my next question.
I was going to say, a lot of people ask me, well, what did you do when you worked? And I always say that it essentially would be easier to tell you what I didn't do on a short list than go through everything that I have done in that period of time. But the longest predominant period was in the investment side of things.
Some of the other things you did were very pragmatic and involved physical contributions.
Yeah, I, again, had a real... bond with an aunt and uncle who had a cattle ranch, a small cow-calf operation in the Caribou, so I always had a fascination about that. So I actually got into farming at a small hay ranch in the Lumbee area for a number of years, and I also ran a feed supply business for a few years, got into electrical work. I was an electrician at one point, and I worked in an electrical and plumbing supply place for a while. I was a manager of the Chamber of Commerce for a while. I was quite involved. So I get the list of things I didn't do is shorter.
You know, isn't it true that our life paths are never straight and narrow? They're all over the place, and I think that's what gives us our interesting characteristics. Mention once again that I'm speaking with Howie McMillan and Jennifer Chinecki, who are respectively coordinators and manager of the downtown Salmon Arm Farmers Market. Jennifer, your path led to art. You went to Emily Carr, and then you really got serious in the work you did in sort of not just doing art, which you still do, even with the kids at the farmers market, but also with the how the fine arts world works and how groups function. And you became, in fact, on a number of occasions, a number of settings, curator, preparator, teaching design, fine art leader in different... Why don't you just talk about the kind of work you did?
Sure, yeah. My history is pretty interesting. I first ran an artist collective that became really established, and I did that for about 6.5 years in downtown Vancouver in Mount Pleasant. And then I moved, but all through university and this time, I was working for the Pitt Meadows Museum, and I was the assistant curator for over a decade there. So I slowly but surely rebuilt the entire museum. I designed all the exhibits, and it's a small museum, so I did a lot of programming and everything. You know, when in these small museums, you tend to wear a lot of hats. So it was really lovely.
Looks like that in a volunteer radio station as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I stayed there for 19 years, which is, you know, kind of a funny anomaly these days to see.
It became a bit of a family kind of community sort of thing.
Yeah, there was a community built around this small museum, so it was a really lovely place. But then I later moved on to working for the city of Burnaby, where I had some really beautiful jobs. Most notably, I worked for several years as a preparator for the Burnaby Village Museum. And one of my major assignments there is that I did conservation on the 1911 C.W. Parker Carousel. So that was something that we did twice annually, because this carousel is ridden by around 100,000 people a year. So it needs constant maintenance.
Where is this item located?
It's at Deer Lake Park in the big Burnaby Village Museum. It's an open air museum.
I'm afraid to say I've never ridden on it.
Oh, it needs to be ridden. It's a beautiful thing.
I feel like
I've
missed something in life. then the art gallery.
Yeah, and then I worked for the Burnaby Art Gallery as in kind of a programming role, where I wrote and taught and did a lot of stuff around public programming, interpreting the exhibitions to the public.
The village... Burnaby Village Museum. Mm-hmm. What sort of time span does it tend to cover? Is it mostly settler world?
It's mostly 1910. They are pretty specific. It's mostly 1920. They're very specific there. They really wanted to nail down a concrete timeline with their representation. But it is a very diverse and wonderful place, because there was lots going on in Burnaby at that time. There was a really strong Chinese community and indigenous community.
Which is what I was sort of in the back of my mind thinking, how we've tended to estimate history beginning when settlers first arrived in this part of the world, you know, homesteaders, as you both pointed out. And we're just starting to understand that the culture that was here already has something to teach us, and that's becoming more and more part of what we think about. And I always kind of bring it up because it comes in the back of my mind. I've been working with some indigenous people locally and in other parts of the country on bringing back some of the focus that was there. And it's something that can animate our own perspective on things. You know, we can collaborate and work together and learn from them, as opposed to the past way, which was they learn from us, not always well and not always happily. Mm-hmm. So let's get back to the farmer's market.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're supposed to be talking about. Jennifer, I want to touch on this concept of relational aesthetics. You mentioned it was one of the things that you were learning when you were at Emily Carr. And maybe just morph it in a little bit to what impact it has on what you do with the farmer's market.
Yeah, so relational aesthetics is looking at how things look, but then how people are interacting with them. So when I work on projects, events, or any sort of major public project, I look at the whole thing, how it looks and how people are navigating it, mostly for pleasure, truly. It's just to make it a better thing.
Yes, who was it? Keats, who said, beauty is truth and truth is beauty. That's all you need to know.
There you are.
That sounds like an original relational aesthetics observation. Now, both of you arrived in the farmer's market from a slightly different path. Howie, you did research. You did research on this part of the world to say, where am I going to go next? How did that work out?
When I decided to retire some 4 years ago, I, being an analytical type, researched in a number of communities where it would be optimal to retire, and then narrowed that down to three or four from various criteria. And that process was what led me to Salmon Arm. I identified it as being an ideal scenario for my lifestyle, for my worldview.
All right, tell us a little about your lifestyle and worldview that we share here in Salmon Arm.
As you mentioned, I was a foodie, I guess, to begin with, and then my bent was more a nutrition, and then starting to look at how you source that and how that happens. That evolved into kind of looking at some of the threats or vulnerabilities to our food supply. And that again led to, you know, what would happen if some of these threats were realized. And in recent history, we've seen that in the summer, last summer, various times and that type of thing.
And then you met Serena.
Yeah. So when I first arrived at Salmon Arm, the first thing to do to connect if you're a local or and into local food was to source out things at the farmer's market. And virtually the first time I came to the market, a few weeks after moving here, I met Serena from the Shuswap Food Action Society and a number of the long-term vendors at the market and got plugged into that environment. Backing up a little bit in that process of deciding where to live, I discovered the Shuswap Food Action Society online long before I moved here, and it was a contributing factor to the decision to move to Salmon Arm.
You liked what you saw.
They, at that time, and arguably remain on the leading edge of food and local food and food security and that type of thing, and that really resonated with me. That was a contributing factor to the reason I moved to Salmon Arm.
This is one of those and the rest is history moments where you moved on. Jennifer, when you first came here, it was because you'd read about a position that was available. The job description caught your fancy. What was it you read that made you think this would be a good place to go?
Well, I was just really interested in gardening and local food as well, but mostly in education around teaching people how to garden. And that was a big... So I do more work than just run the farmer's market. I also work in kind of a communications role. And I was just really attracted to that. I thought it sounded good.
What about the community? Was it the job, or was it the job and the community?
Well, my partner and I had been looking to move out of the city. So we were just kind of brainstorming places that we could go. And we just really liked the Shuswap area.
And there, in particular, your experience organizing events, organizing groups, managing numbers of people working alongside one another, that would have been a relevant thing to consider.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
And Jennifer, there was one thing you said when we were talking before the show about having a capacity to grab an idea and make it work. How does that process work in your mind? That was obviously relevant to working in the farmer's market. Things are happening all the time and you catch on to something and you move with it.
Yeah, I saw the farmer's market and it was already thriving and buzzing. I'm not going to take credit for that. It's a beautiful place. But
and Howie helped to orient you when you first came.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Howie trained me, and the Shuswap Food Action Society and Serena and Howie have built this beautiful market. But I just have a aesthetic eye and I just saw a little... improvements and ways that we could, I'm always looking for improvements, bringing in more special guests and nonprofit groups to kind of share knowledge and just little points of interest to help keep people, you know, entertained and down there a little longer and really making it more and more of a community hub, which it already was, but it's just my
goal. Always ways to enhance and enlighten what's going on.
Yeah.
So why don't we move from the theoretical a little bit to the actual practical. A day at the downtown Salmon Arm Farmers Market, which starts early in the morning. So as I understand, Howie is a 6:30 a.m. kind of guy, and Jennifer's a 6:45 next phase to mm-hmm. come in. So Howie, you get there at 6:30. What the heck's going on?
Interestingly, although the market summer season doesn't start until 9 o'clock. When I get there at 6:30, there are two or three of our vendors already there, starting their setup process. And at that stage, that's what we're doing. We closed Hudson through traffic for the market. So there's barricades to move out. There's road signage to put up. There's our own booth at the market next to the stage to set up. So Jennifer and I essentially work on that process from 6:30 until essentially more of the flow of vendor starts. And then a big part of what Jennifer's doing and I'm helping with this is essentially getting vendors set up. In the summer season, we have on average around 40 vendors. At peak season, we have a little over 50. So it is a logistical challenge, and it's...
You didn't say nightmare, congratulations for that.
Fortunately, a lot of our full-time vendors are in the same location by design. Jennifer sets that up. So they are low maintenance, but a lot of new or drop-in vendors, when they arrive at the market, some of them are never having been at our market. It's a process to get them to where they're setting up, helping them set up, and that type of thing.
And Jennifer, I understand you're the digital communication person, and there's a lot of stuff flying back and forth.
There is, yeah. I have a map, and I have a lot of last-minute emails every week, so it's pretty fun. I mean, on Fridays, I tend to do a lot of the last-minute work because there's just movement, you know? People realize they don't have as much produce as they thought they did, or something's come up with their family, or somebody decides they want to come. So that's the kind of last-minute rearranging that's done every Friday.
Is this a little different from what you were doing in your previous work, this sort of on-the-go movement, constant change sort of thing? I mean, museums, by definition, are studying things that happened a long time in the past, and that's their content. But this is a very lively, interactive kind of process from what you're saying.
It's true, yeah. I would say it's a little similar to working in programming where you end up getting teachers that get sick or drop out and you have to go teach last minute classes. I did that a lot. But it's really busy, but it's also very well organized. I built our whole market map in a multi-page PDF from the very get-go, and Howie and I both can see it at all times through the week, so it's set up like clockwork. It's pretty easy to follow.
And how are you doing some of the heavy lifting, or at least some lifting? I don't know what your back's like, but
pushing.
Well, that's good. Yeah. That's close to lifting, but more horizontal. What kind of stuff? There's a lot of stuff to do, right?
Yeah, it's a process. The first hour from 6:30 to 7:30 is pretty much a good workout for an old guy like me. There's a lot of moving parts and a lot of things that have to be done, and it's a good workout, yeah. And takedown is a similar scenario. All of the stuff, we have a storage shed, which is full. So again, you have to have a system to get everything in there. You can't just throw everything in there at the end of the day.
So it's fair to say the vendors keep most of their stuff close to where the market is going to be set up.
The vendors bring all of their own stuff. They're responsible for their stall, as it's called, a 10x10 space. But yeah, all of the other paraphernalia, if you will, the equipment, the tent for our setup, the
cement
traffic,
blocks,
the traffic
signage,
barriers, the highway signage, all
it's
that
a lot
stuff.
Of stuff.
Yeah. Oh dear, yeah. I must admit, I've wondered where all that stuff went. But clearly, you have a little designated. We will not reveal where it is so that the community doesn't traipse up to your door. But that's a process that sounds like it's pretty busy. And there's a sense of a deadline, right? You've got I think you said to me earlier that it was about 10 to 9. Things are more or less in place or have to be kind of more or less in place. Is that how it works?
Yeah, essentially the expectation from the vendor's point of view is they're ready to go at 8:45.
And there's people who come around early, right, Jennifer? Mm-hmm.
Try to buy coffees, to buy buns.
And the vendors are always sort of torn. Well, I'd kind of like to give you some coffee. And
if we don't see it, I mean.
Yes, it's the police. The thought police are not busy. So there's this sort of flow that brings out the market and puts it into concrete existence in the plaza. Mm-hmm. And then what happens? I guess then the crowds start to gather.
They do. And I also want to say that 8:45 to 9 o'clock period is a really interesting time where vendors are able to go and trade. A lot of them trade. And also just visit. Because once the market starts, they get stuck there. And I often go and say, I'll watch a booth for you for 10 minutes if you need it. Mm-hmm. I sometimes hop into other people's booths and sell their stuff or stand there.
But, so they're interacting
yeah.
a lot.
Oh, yeah.
It must be interesting for them to see that they have a place to go and do that.
Yeah, they have a little vendor
family
groups.
They're not out in their farm digging up, you know, hardy native perennials known as weeds. They're actually on site with like-minded people.
Yeah. And then from the 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock period, it's often a little slower. People are just getting downtown. But you start to see families come to set up, and they get set up for the live music. They find their spot. And by 10 o'clock, we're pretty much cracking pretty good because it's still pretty cool, right?
So, indeed.
Yeah.
2,800 people. I can't get that number out of my head. That's just a heck of a lot of people.
It's a lot of people sometimes, yeah. I always try to get videos at that high time when the market is completely full.
Howie, you've had more than 1 year of watching. What have you noticed over the years that you've been observing the farmers market in terms of any changes?
Yeah, this is the fifth season of the current downtown market. And I arrived here 4 years ago, and it was set up in the Ross Street parking lot. It's interesting because I'm there pretty much every market, and I'm sort of in the background once the market's running. And my analytical background, I'm measuring these things. And we have seen significant growth in our market, especially in the last couple of years. This is our second full year on the closed Hudson Avenue. And I would guess that summer season attendance is up somewhere in that 40 to 50% range over the last couple of years. And this will be our third year of the winter market. And the second year in the winter market, the attendance literally doubled. And the number of vendors almost doubled. We're seeing really rapid growth.
Just to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Howie McMillan and Jennifer Chenecki, who are respectively coordinator and manager of the highly successful Salmon Arm Downtown Farmers Market. So you've got set up, the people are there, and then the flow begins.
That's right. Yeah.
Talk about the flow, Jennifer. This is a relational aesthetics kind of word.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Then we can take a little break because we've been hauling around heavy things for a couple hours at that point and running around and communicating. So we usually kind of take turns manning our booth, and I usually find an hour or two to sit and color with kids, which is like probably my favorite time of the day.
Talk about what happens. Talk about your favorite time.
Well, I put out a basket of chalk, a basket of bubbles, and a basket of ribbon. And I illustrate coloring sheets for the kids. And then I just sit there with a little crew around me in color. It's quite nice.
How do they find you?
I don't know. They just come. I think there's always been kids' activities offered up there. But it's important that we're at the booth because people come with, adults come with questions about Shoe Swap Food Action, about how to volunteer, about how to contribute to the shoebox fund. And there's a lot of stuff that it's just good to have somebody. So Howie and I kind of trade off, but I like to spend a good couple hours sitting there and working with the people.
So Howie is at the booth fielding the adults' questions, and you're dealing with the kids.
No, I do both. Yeah we take turns, yeah.
But it's clear that this, it's not just a market, it's a social hub where people come to interact. Farmers and other vendors come to interact. People who are buying things come to interact. And a lot of people, having attended a number of markets myself, this is a true story and full disclosure, there's a lot of activity that goes on that's just purely social. People are just hanging out saying, what about this and what about that? The vendors are wonderfully open. They really, I mean, they're selling some products, but they're also, they're happy to talk to. And we've had a number of them on this show, and they've been really, there's a splendid community of producers and vendors in this area. So as things wind down, then the reverse movement takes place. How are you get your back warmed up and away we go? Is that sort of how things happen?
Yeah, it's a reverse is the good way of putting it. Essentially, we take down everything. We also help the vendors with their takedown and get it out. Our permit for the closure of the street ends at 2 o'clock. Market ends at 1. But some of the vendors, as I say, sometimes at 5 to 2, we're helping them get off there because we have to take the barricades down into traffic.
I wouldn't say sometimes. I would say
all the time.
Every time. Yeah, but it's kind of fun. It's like a nice time to really bond with some of the vendors when you're helping them pack up their remaining vegetables. Yeah. It's a lovely time, yeah.
The other thing I would back up to, and that's the survey, and you talked about the social atmosphere and the ambiance and the fun at the market. When they did the dot plot for the survey, they asked people their primary reason for coming to the market. And 20% of the respondents, of the 233 respondents, indicated that the social atmosphere at the market was the primary reason they came to the market.
You know, in our world of not being with people, but being in our households or in our particular private space and nattering away with our thumbs, it's, I think, a time when there is a certain craving for just being with your fellow citizens, whoever they may be, and just hanging out and interacting and having a little fun. And I am forced to confess, Howie, that I am one of the 20% who goes for a little social interaction and some veggies and some baked goods. So it's a place that serves a multiple of purposes and roles. So the farmer's market on the day is now closed down. The street is cleared. The traffic moves on through without crushing any vendors because they're gone. But that's not the end of the farmer's market, because there's special events and other kinds of interactions with the food community that take place, one of which is the Apple Fest.
That's right. It's on October 7th this year.
So what's the Apple Fest? Because I've actually not been yet, although I've come very close to going. But I know a lot of people who go to it, and they say it's really a lot of fun, too.
So it's kind of just an extension of our regular market with more of an apple slant. We're going to have a mobile juicer where people can bring their apples and get them juiced. And then we're going to have several apple vendors offering different taste tests of different varieties. We're also going to have a couple of special contests this year. So we're working with Peterson's Orchard, and we're going to have a children's homegrown apple contest. So kids can bring their apples up to our booth between noon and 12:30, and we're going to judge them on size and most beautiful apple. So calling all kids, bring out your apple that day.
It's hard to judge an apple without actually taking a bite out of it, isn't it?
I mean, maybe that'll have to be part of the most beautiful.
A little slice off the back where nobody can see it.
Yeah.
And then there's a special Christmas market, or before Christmas market, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this will be our third year running a Christmas market, which the winter market is restricted in size to just the plaza. But working with Downtown Salmon Arm and Jen and Althea, we have permitted and are using the full closure of the 200 block of Hudson again for a full Christmas market. So Santa will be there. There will be carolers. The Tuba Christmas folks are there. It's an extended market. It's a little longer. And it's just like the regular peak season summer. It's busy. A lot of people come out for that. And the Downtown Salmon Arm has their Christmas promotions and everything working and that type of thing. Merchants have sales and everything else. So it's a big event to kick off the sort of peak run-up to the Christmas season.
And is this event expanding as you've seen it? It's now the third year?
It's essentially always been popular simply because most of the artisan and craft vendors and everything else are all looking for, because that's kind of a peak season for them. For the vegetable grower, it's peak season now. If you're an artisan at the market and you're producing a lot of holiday-related stuff, they want to be at that market. So we've had over 40 vendors for that Christmas market both years, and we expect the same again this year.
Very busy place. Jennifer, the Teaching Garden, there's a kind of interactive connection with the Teaching Garden. I mean, just because they're part of the Shuswap Food Action Society's portfolio.
Mm-hmm. It's one of our major projects, the garden that's on 30th on the way to Canoe Beach. So we are having one last big event there, and it's next Thursday, the 28th. So we're doing our annual garden cleanup. And even if you're a brand new volunteer or guest to the garden, you can still show up. We're having a potluck. That starts at around 5:30, and then we're going to be doing our garden cleanup, which also includes using a cover crop, which not everyone does in their garden. So it will be quite interesting. And you can find more information, of course, on our website or our Facebook or Instagram channels for Shoe Swap Food Action.
What cover crop? What cover crop is going to be used?
I'm not sure. Maybe red clover or something like that. Yeah, I'm not actually
nitrogen.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, it's a very old way of making sure that the soil is good. You put in something that you don't eat. You put it to make the soil a better kind of soil.
And keep the soil down as well, right?
Yes, indeed. Yep. That's right. That's
keep it
what
in place.
The Dust Bowl. We remember what happened to the Dust Bowl. I want to step back a little bit and have you reflect, each of you reflect a little bit on what the role of the market, the farmer's market, is in the community from different points of view, from the farmer's point of view, from the community's point of view, from individual citizens' point of view. Howie, you've had some extra years engaged with it. What are your thoughts about what the farmer market does to all of us in the community?
Yeah, to my mind, it's sort of the ideal interface between small-scale farmers, bakers, and that type of thing, and their end customer. It's a really easy format for someone who's small and or starting out to get the products to the market. We attract that 2,900 people at peak season type of thing. And essentially for a very low stall fee, that farmer can bring their produce, their meat, their eggs, whatever it happens to be. The artisan can bring their crafts and that type of thing to the market. And that's an interface. And as we've been discussing, it's also a very warm, friendly, ambient place where people are actually enjoying themselves. So the process of developing relationships, the so-called know your farmer type of sentiment, is actually almost automatic at a farmer's market. It's fun, it's friendly, the products are there, the freshness of the food, the values that are associated with nutrition and good health are all there. So a farmer's market is essentially a perfect interface between customers or purchasers and the producers, the farmers, the artisans, and that type of thing.
And every penny that is spent at the farmer's market goes into the pocket of the farmer who produced the food without, you know, a distributor network, without sort of middle people in a row taking a slice off what's being sold.
Yeah, very true. Essentially, it's a direct connection. So the farmer is getting every one of those dollars. And as Jennifer said, one of the neat things about the market is how the vendors shop with each other. So when we talk about economic impacts and multiplier effects, it starts right there in that process. So yeah, it's essentially the ideal entry point for a lot of small-scale farmers.
Jennifer, the teaching side of food, I have a vision of you as a small girl with your grandmothers in the garden, and they were telling, well this way, I'm going to do it over here, I'm going to do it over that way. Talk about that a little bit. It's a learning experience. Everybody's learning something. They're learning something about other people. They're learning something about what's available in their community that they can use for themselves. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I do a lot of communications for the market, and I think it's been really interesting to help deliver that message out to the general public of what the farmers market is really providing. And then in the moment as well, of course, I make little worksheets for kids so they can learn more about what's in the market and fresh food and things like that. But we also bring in, I'll pretty much say yes to any nonprofit. So we've had such wonderful guests. Of course, we have Shoe Swap Climate Action is a regular, but we've had the Invasive
Species Society
coming. Mm-hmm. We've had Hatchachick come on the smokiest day of the year. He joined us, and we got to learn about raising chicks and holding chicks and things like that. We recently had the mobile seed cleaning unit come from Farm Folk City Folk. So we just really have a really nice amount of special guests that bring in different knowledge sources and different dialogues around local food and local growing.
So what you're describing is outreach beyond the community as well as fostering interactions within the community.
Yeah, and I'd say it's more like the larger community of the region or the province. So it's not too broad, but yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yes, I'm just musing on this because it's, you know, networks, we talk a lot about networks and networking, but it's often an unconscious process or something that happens by itself. You don't have to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're describing now is how when something works really well in one community, then other people hear about it, you know, and they say, well, let's talk to these people and find out. Do you find that, have you had people yet come to say, gosh, we hear that the farmer's market's going pretty well, we're trying to start one up, that kind of thing?
I definitely talk to a lot of people from out of town that remark on the farmer's market. Yeah. That's a regular at our booth, so yeah. They just like it. I don't know if they want to start one, but they like it.
Well, that's often how it begins. You know, you like something, and then you look around for it, you can't find it, so you say, well, I know some people who might help out with that. Howie, what would you say the future is for farmers markets?
I think the future is much like the recent past. If you look at the stats continent-wide, farmers markets are exploding in numbers and breadth. And I see that increasing. As part of my process, I refer to myself as a local four, and I think the solution to a lot of our food issues is the localization of our food system.
Absolutely.
And we're talking about that at a broader levels. But essentially, I think they will continue to grow. We will get more of them, and they will be bigger, and there will be more focus, simply because more and more of the issues that we are facing on a day-to-day basis are driving home an issue that if I want to eat, I may better make sure that I'm looking after the local farmers that are producing that food. So I see nothing but upside for both farmers markets, farm gate stores, and local food in general, simply because of those trends.
It's a serious transformational process. Jennifer, any final comments that you'd like to make about the farmers market world that you've just plunged into?
It's really beautiful. And I think that, you know, I don't know if Howie gets enough credit for the hard work that he's been doing at the market. I'm an employee of the market, and Howie is our faithful head volunteer who donates his time week after week to haul bricks around and drag signs out to the highway. So I think that most of the vendors understand that, but I would say the general public doesn't. So thank you, Howie.
You're welcome.
That's wonderful. Your quick impression of where things are going in the future.
I think they are good. I think people have more and more people are coming, and we've seen new people coming even just this year. So we all know that food in the grocery store is pretty pricey. So if you can buy, you know, local food that's in season, you're going to find it in the same price zone, and it's going to be fresh out of the garden that, you know, from the day before or something. So I think it's only going to get better and better.
I can certainly say, as a physician, I have observed over the years a renewed interest in quality of food rather than quantity. And in fact, policies are starting to be established around that approach. And I think what you're both involved with is a project that is very, in very concrete ways, embedded in this transformational process away from 5,000 kilometer food that's come from the other side of the world, away from massive amounts of greenhouse gas production in order to get that food where we want it to be, because we all know that that's not doing the planet any good right now, but also because it's an incubator for human relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very nice place to relate to somebody over a plate of food or a bag of veggies, or a sense that you have obtained what you really need, which is something to eat, but also had an enjoyable experience in getting it. So I want to thank both of you. You've been a real inspiration, I'm sure, to a lot of listeners, Jennifer Chenecki and Howie McMillan from the shoe shop, this Salmon Arm Downtown Farmers Market. I think you've You've told a story that a lot of people really wanted to hear and needed to hear, and we're grateful for you for coming on the show and doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Warren.
Yes, thanks.